We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Blue Wire.
NBA Most Valuable Player, Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Giannis trailing the lob. Giannis Antetokounmpo.
2 seconds.
Hey there, welcome to the Eurostep, a Milwaukee Bucks podcast, proudly a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network and the Eurostep Podcast Network. We've got extra time between games, which means extra time to talk about the NBA Finals now that the Bucks have taken a game, now down 2-1 to Phoenix with another home game in Milwaukee looming on Wednesday. I'm joined, as always, by my energetic co-host, Rohan Kadi, and we have a guest this time. We've shouted him out on the last several collab pods, so we thought who better to bring on than Jackson Frank, words all over the internet, all of the good websites, also host of The House That Hinkie Built here on Blue Wire. He's everywhere. His tweets are blowing up. Jackson, Rohan, how's it going?
I'm doing well. I appreciate you having me on today. Excited to talk about some Bucks Suns.
I mean, yeah, I'm excited. We have a great guest. We're coming off of a good win. It's a few days off because of MLB stuff for some reason, but it's good to have a little bit of a rest. I feel like the finals have just been, and just this playoff run have been just so hectic, and it's nice to have some time. So I'm glad we can get together and do this.
I agree. So I want to get started the same way we got started on the post-game 3 pod. And that is, we're going to dive into some nitty-gritty stuff here. I think everyone loves to talk strategy during the finals. We're certainly going to do that. But how can you not talk about Giannis at first? And I just want to throw and get your take, Jackson, on what we've seen from him in the finals. Because as much as we here on the Eurostep Podcast Network, obviously huge fans, literally like namesake of Giannis is the whole thing. But there was always the question, like, what would he look like on a stage like this? There were always playoff questions, everything else. You know, Jay Crowder and Ayton, two guys who have done well defending Giannis in the past. The Suns, a very good team on both ends. Feels like he's answered a lot of questions, back-to-back 40 burgers. He's putting himself in rare, esteemed statistical company already through just 3 finals games. You know, what are your overall thoughts on what we've seen from Giannis so far? Before we dive into the specific parts of Bucks Suns.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's been most impressive is, you know, in game one, he came out of the gates looking pretty good. You know, it was his first game in a week or so after the hyperextension in his knee. But at some point in the second half, he just kind of seemed to, I don't know exactly what the phrase is, but he just didn't quite seem to be, you know, he was playing in the corner a little bit, was off the ball a ton. And you know, there's maybe concerns like, Is he going to be less than 100%? Like, is this the Giannis we're going to get? Like, you know, a guy who's still very good, but, you know, you can't have him score 20 points a game and that be who he is if you want to win a title. And these last two, he's been awesome. He's still kind of coming out early in the first quarter for that little rest that people always seem to fret over. And then all of a sudden, Giannis is fine because that's just what he's done, you know, as of late. But I've been most impressed by, one, the conditioning level we've seen. Because Giannis, he's a fantastic conditioned athlete. I mean, especially these playoffs that you've seen from him. But especially after game one, that was not surprising, but it's impressive how he's kind of bounced back there. And then just the ways he and the Bucks are kind of, you know, applying his skill set, you know, for so long, or not so long, you know, when Giannis made his kind of announcement to be an MVP type player, there was so much of that kind of that four out of random attack from the top of the key. But in these finals, he's just crushing Phoenix in the mid post. He's getting a few, you know, empty corner pick and rolls where he's finishing at the rim. Yesterday, obviously, he shot, you know, 76.5% from the line. So just really impressed in kind of how he bounced back from not a bad game one, but like a little underwhelming compared to what the Bucks needed for him to win this series, and just the way he's being used and kind of representing the way he's grown as a scorer over the last year or so.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it. I think on their last post-game pod, Ty, we forgot to mention just putting Giannis's historical significance into context, that he is, once again, just a week and a half removed, 2 weeks from that gruesome injury he thought was season-ending. It's incredible. And Jackson, you mentioned like the empty corner pick and rolls and stuff like that. I thought throughout these playoffs that we've seen an evolution of Giannis as a player. We still saw a lot of those, top of the key going one on five sort of plays that Tyrese Halliburton called the fullback dive in the latest low post, which I thought was fantastic. But we saw a lot of those early on, even throughout this regular season. We saw it a little bit more than we had liked to see. It was drastically reduced compared to previous years, but we still saw it. In these playoffs, like starting in the Brooklyn series, we started to see it a lot more. We started to see this team play a lot of isolation ball a lot. And it bothered us because we knew that it wasn't going to be like a tenable solution and it wasn't going to work. And they eventually remedied that and they went on to win that series and get to the finals. We've seen that evolution take place because in game three against Phoenix, there were a lot of instances where Giannis was like, okay, I have a chance to attack here on my own, but no, I can flow into a quick pick and roll. I think the one with Pat Connaughton really epitomized that in that it was on the, I think it was the left side of the floor. He tried to attack Jay Crowder in isolation, just flowed into a screen and roll with Pat Connaughton, and so like Pat Connaughton's not like an elite ball handler or anything. He's not someone you want in like a pick and roll situation, but it doesn't matter because his drive on his own and Giannis setting a good screen, making sure Chris Paul gets behind the ball handler, it opens up so much space for Giannis to just attack. And it's simple things like that we've seen evolve in Giannis's game throughout this postseason run, and it's really all coming to fruition in these finals.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just important that it feels like it's kind of clicked for Giannis and the team. Like, it's not a weakness if you need to be set up to operate optimally, right? Like, there's a handful of players in the league that it doesn't matter, like Kawhi, KD, etc., where, you know, you could set a screen, but you don't have to. I'm sure the data says it matters, but it feels like it doesn't matter at least. Giannis is not really a player like that, especially when, you know, he's going to get doubled. It's at least from the top of the key. I think from the post, like you mentioned, Jackson, they've been setting him up, especially on mismatches closer to the basket. And, you know, then one-on-one, he's just going to destroy guys. Attacking a set defense one-on-five is not optimal. And that's when the Bucks get in trouble. But it's been great to just see the evolution of how he plays and how everyone plays with him. And yeah, I mean, I think it's instructive to look at the Pat Connaughton example, because if Pat can be the ball handler with Giannis and it works, like, I think that's a test case that it'll work for just about anybody, right? Like, no disrespect to a Bucks legend who I've said if they win it all, put his jersey in the rafters, but I didn't say it because he's a great pick and roll ball handler.
But yeah, I think what's been most impressive, I don't know, most impressive, one of the impressive things too is like to start these playoffs, like Giannis, he wasn't great offensively. Like, you know, despite the Bucks, you know, dismantling the Heat, like Giannis's numbers weren't great in that series. And he was really good in game one against the Nets. And then he wasn't great in game two, and he was pretty good in game three. But kind of since game four of that Nets series, he's just been on another level. He's at, you know, over his last 11 games, he's averaging 31.5 points, 12.5 rebounds, 4.5 assists, a steal and a block. And that comes out to be, just checking the math here quickly, over those 11 games for him, 63.5% true shooting. So 31 on 63.5 true shooting is pretty dang ridiculous. So you've just seen him get better, you know, in the playoffs, right? Which isn't always the case. Sometimes guys have great you know, rounds one or two because they're playing on a better team against a lesser opponent, and then they start to fall off. With Giannis, it's been the opposite. You're seeing everything he and the Bucks kind of work toward in this regular season to kind of make him a more complete offensive player, you know, with the mid-post stuff, getting the ball at the elbow, you do running more pick and rolls or whatnot. I don't actually know if he ran more pick and roll statistically in the regular season, but all the things that you can kind of do with Giannis beyond just say, you know, go attack from the top of the key, he is doing it, especially over the last, you know, the second half of this playoff run. So that's been really impressive. You're seeing him kind of just take a step forward in the most important rounds, and it has the Bucks, you know, with a chance to win the title.
Before we move on past Pat Connaughton, Jackson, I want to know what are your thoughts on Ty saying that if the Bucks win the title, Pat Connaughton should get his jersey retired?
I don't know how I feel, but I mean, he's done some nice things, but if they get two, we can give Pat if Giannis
thank
can
you.
Lead him
thank
to
you.
A couple. I think we got to be a little. I mean, Giannis will get his number retired regardless of what happens this year. I'm sure. You know, we'll get Chris in there as well, but let's wait to give Pat his flowers until they get a second one. But he's done some nice things in these playoffs, especially in game two. I know they didn't win game two, but Pat was quite good in game two, especially it was a turnaround from his game one startles.
If they get two, I'm going to be advocating for a statue of Pat. And, you know, it'll be fitting. Maybe they can buy the real estate from Pat that they put the Pat statue on and really come full circle. But I like the sound of the Bucks getting two, though, after getting one 50 years ago, and that's it. So let's talk about defense now, Rohan. You teased it. Specifically, the way the Bucks are defending the pick and roll, because that feels like, you know, that's the defensive action that really matters, right? And if you, including Spain pick and roll, all the screens, basically, how the Bucks handle Suns screens, because that's so much of the great stuff that the Suns do on offense is some variation of Ayton and or other guys screening for Chris Paul and Devin Booker. And I think game one, what we saw was a very aggressive five-man switching where even if the Suns weren't setting great screens, the Bucks were automatically giving Lopez to Booker or Paul, and those guys were enjoying that. Not as much as many people thought or posted. I admit that, or I concede that, but They were making it very easy for Phoenix to pick the matchups they wanted and essentially taking PJ Tucker and, more importantly, Drew Holiday out of actions. And then in the third quarter of that game, they go back to the deep drop, and that just like lit a fire for Phoenix. I think since then, we have seen the Bucks make it the adjustment that I've seen, and I want to hear from you, Jackson, and then also you, Rohan, of course, but it seems like the biggest takeaway is no matter how they're doing it differently, we see some traps with Portis. I think that's more because of Portis than anything. But it seems like the Bucks are really striving to keep Drew and PJ on CP and Booker. Even if it opens up the opportunity for, you know, a step back three real quickly or someone's diving to the rim and the Bucks have to rotate over and help. Like, they're saying, listen, we'll allow some of that, those looks. We're not going to let CP get comfortable against our worst defenders the whole game. We're not going to do that. You're going to have to beat Drew Holiday and PJ and Chris Middleton and Giannis if you're going to score one-on-one. And those guys are still going to do that sometimes. I mean, they're going to score on everyone. They're great players. But to me, that's what's been the big difference. I think we've seen it. It's made a huge impact on the game. And, of course, they've gone smaller as well. We've seen that. But Jackson, what are your thoughts on how the Bucks' defense has evolved as this series has gone on?
Yeah, well, I think one thing you got to give the coaches have a lot of credit for is they haven't been short on throwing everything Phoenix's way, right? I mean, first half of game two alone, I think they had four different coverages, whether it was
I heard Bud has never made an adjustment, not once.
We'll get into that later, but yeah, the Bud stuff is people are off base about what to harp on him for, but. That's what I've been impressed by is that, you know, they're trying a lot of different things in game three. Well, even going back to game two, like they opened with Drew basically pressuring Chris Paul from the moment he touches the ball. But in game three, there was an even bigger emphasis. I think there was a play early in that game where Ayton ended up scoring, but they had like four different guys crowding Chris Paul upon his touch, and then they were kind of scrambled. But that was kind of what they wanted to do is they made their pickup points really high. They didn't want to let Chris Paul kind of get into those early offense actions that Phoenix really kind of crutches teams with. I tweeted it yesterday, I think, when I was rewatching the game, but any offense, but especially Phoenix, loves to take advantage of the, just the space a defense will typically concede as a possession unwinds or, you know, begins. And Milwaukee said, we're not going to give you that. They had like 4 to 5 guys above the 3-point line picking up, picking up their assignments there, trying not to let them, you know, flow into those Spain pick and rollers or those high screen rolls, those double drags. And then once DeAndre Ayton was in foul trouble, the Bucks basically realized, okay, the Suns have no interior scoring threat. CP is a great player, of course, still, but he's not someone who's going to put a lot of pressure on the rim. Mikal can get there with cuts and stuff. And Mikal was a little, he was unsure of himself yesterday, which has happened at times. Booker had I don't know exactly what's up with Devin Booker, but he settled for a lot of threes yesterday. He didn't play, I think, what, the last 10 or so minutes of that game. And so the Bucks just realized, if we just pressure this team a ton, we probably have at least as good of athletes. We have more length. That'll make things really tough. And so they basically just said, sure, like if you want to back cut us or drive to the rim, you can try it, but we don't think you have the personnel to do it. And we're not worried about Frank Kaminsky as a finisher. When you go small, we're definitely not worried about you having kind of guys who can put pressure on the rim or in the paint. So that was most impressive. They just really kind of, it felt like Phoenix was responding to everything Milwaukee was doing defensively, rather than, you know, typically it's the offense, you know, makes the first move and the defense responds. And so maybe that's a little cliche or simplified, but I was just very impressed by the way Milwaukee, you know, really forced Phoenix to go to plan B or C or reset a possession, because that doesn't happen very often. Typically Phoenix is great about, you know, doing what it wants and having, you know, the outcome, you know, flow as it prefers.
I don't think that's an overly simple way to put it. I think it's a lot of, like, instead of Phoenix setting the tone in this game, in game three, I should say, Milwaukee's was starting to set the tone. It's a lot of defensive evolution, like you mentioned, throughout this series so far. There's just been a lot of coverages. You mentioned they showed, like, what was it, 4 different coverages, in, at least in the first half, in terms of pick and roll defense. It's just, you see that they learned a lot from the Brooklyn series in terms of, like, mindset. Obviously not in terms of schematics, because they're playing these very, very, very differently. But what they wanted to do to confuse a guy like Kevin Durant, or at least make life more difficult for him as you possibly can, is just throw everything you can at him and vary it up as much as you can. So you're giving him different looks every time down the floor. They threw Drew on him, they throw PJ, Chris, sometimes Pat Connaughton for some reason. It's just those things would happen. And, you know, it's impossible to stop Kevin Durant, but you sort of make life as difficult as you possibly can do. And that's the same sort of mindset that they're applying in this series. Chris Paul is going to pick apart whatever he wants to in terms of pick and roll. He will do whatever he wants. He'll find whatever weakness that he can find, and he'll exploit it. You saw him doing that in real time in game 3. They started to trap, and they weren't trapping very well. I thought there were a bunch of lazy traps from Brook and Giannis, especially on that one dump off to Kaminsky in the lane. Like, if you're going to trap, you have to actually smother the guy. And if it's Brook and Giannis, you can't just, like, lazily, like, not put your arms all the way out. Like, come on, you guys are 7-footers and Chris Paul's like barely a 6-footer. You can make the passing lane a little more difficult, but that's besides the point. He was picking it apart. He was finding the right pass right away. But the thing is, he had to react to those in real time. Like you mentioned, Jackson, they made Phoenix think. The Milwaukee Bucks made Phoenix think, and that just makes them play a half step slower, which plays into Milwaukee's advantage. Because then you are able to dictate the flow. You are able to dictate how you want this game to be played in terms of pace, in terms of tempo. And that's what leads to a winning formula. And that's how Milwaukee has won a lot of these games in the postseason, by dictating the flow of the game.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned Chris Paul. Like, I mean, Paul's stat line was good last night. I think he had 19-9 on 62% true shooting. Hit some pretty tough shots. Like, he had that one over Giannis in the third quarter that was just outstanding, ability to get that jumper over him. But him giving up 12 inches or whatever it is, or a foot. But it didn't. I don't know. I don't want to be like, oh, like the eye test over the stats. Obviously, Chris Paul played well, but it felt a lot more tough for Chris Paul in game 3 than it did in game 2. Or game 1, whichever one he had. It was game 1, right, when he had the big explosion, then Booker had the game 2,
yeah,
with 7 threes. So it just didn't feel, and I think CP was still good in game 2. It wasn't bad in game 3 by any means, but it felt different, especially once Ayton's minutes were so limited. Like, I think Ayton played like 4.5 minutes in the second half, something like that. And so it just felt like without any sort of, you know, someone to drop the ball off to in his, you know, his probes and those pick and rolls, and with Milwaukee switching everything, and Milwaukee actually had some success at the end of game two, I think, switching. I think they kind of figured that out. They gave Chris Paul some issues there. I just thought it was a lot tougher for Chris Paul. I didn't feel like, you know, the way I've kind of, the phrase I've used a lot as I talk about superstars in these playoffs is like the ripple effect of a guy's, you know, offense. It didn't feel like the ripple effect was there for CP. Everything just felt so methodical and tough, and Chris Paul's a great player. He's an all-time great, and so we still got his, but it didn't feel as effective or impactful, and that's really what stood out to me. But I do want to mention, too, I thought Chris Middleton was way better defensively in Game 3. Like, Game 2, he was just, I mean, on both ends, he was really, really poor. But Game 3, I thought he did a good job switching on to Ayton at times, like not letting Ayton get deep position on those dives or those seals. He had some really nice possessions on the ball against CP and Devin Booker as well. So I just want to give him a little shout-out because I know I'd been critical of him on Twitter. I was critical of him in an article I wrote after the first couple games. So I thought Chris was great on both ends, but particularly on defense, I thought he was really critical to what they were trying to do defensively.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, JJ Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris is like one of the easiest guys, I think, to forget that he's 6'8". And when he plays 6'8", it makes such a huge difference for the Bucks. And it is a both ends thing, but I mean, in earlier rounds, and I think it's a positive for the Bucks that for whatever reason, he's gotten better as almost every series has gone on. We've usually seen his better moments 4, 5, 6, 7, not 1, 2, and in this series 3. Although, like, I agree, the defense much better for him. But, you know, he's like getting offensive rebounds and putbacks. He's defending well. He's locked in. That version of Chris, where he plays more like he's 6'8". You can live a lot better with, oh, it's a bad shooting game for Chris. Like, there's still a lot of ways he can contribute. He didn't do that in game two. I think in game three, he did. I mean, 3 points in the second half is just not good enough. He's got to be better than that. The Bucks obviously won big anyway, so it's not super critical, but I just never want him logging 3 points in a half of a finals game. But I think defensively, if he's locked in there, I mean, honestly, Drew Holiday, outside of, I think it was the 4 threes in the third quarter that were so huge, you know, those aren't going to be there for him every game, but the impact he's making on defense, the playmaking, I want to see Drew shoot more within the arc too. But both of those guys, they need to be involved all over the ball because we've seen in this series already, they're not always going to be consistent offensive contributors. Hopefully Chris is from here on out. They kind of need him to be, but making that impact on defense is so huge. I think the Bucks they're, I mean, this is true of literally every team, probably maybe outside of like the Harden Rockets or something, but their defense sets up their identity so well. And I think it's important. But one thing on defense I want to touch on, or just in general, is Brook Lopez and his role in this series and his minutes. I think he logged 22 in game three, which it was 15 until the fourth quarter when the game was kind of out of hand. The Bucks just went away from him. Some of it was Portis. I think about 8 or 9 minutes was just Giannis and no center out there. And it's so tough because I understand the switching has done well against Phoenix. I think the idea there is simple. I mean, you talk about CP not being able to have as much of a ripple effect. And I think Ayton not playing much in the second half plays into that. Booker not playing much or playing well in the second half has a lot to do with that. I think those two guys are pretty clearly engineered to be the co-leading ball handler on the team. If you take one out for an extended stretch, it just gets so much harder. But I think the other thing is when the Bucks are switching, suddenly you're just not giving up some of the easy passes that have been there, especially in game one. I mean, in game one, they were letting Book and CP often just pass to each other wide open from three, and it was just bad. But and the switching is easier without Lopez. Basically, whenever he's not out there, you feel better about 1 through 5, even if you don't want to totally do it with Portis. Certainly when neither of those guys are out there, the Bucks are going to be switching. But Lopez is good. And as I know you've pointed out, the Bucks, you know, for all the concerns about switching or whatever else, like they, outside of game one when they got torched in that third quarter mostly, they usually haven't gotten absolutely annihilated in his minutes. He's held up on switches. He defends the rim in a way and rebounds in a way that no one else on the Bucks does. Jackson, we had this discussion last night. I don't know if we came to a good answer. Where are you at on how much Lopez should play and the role he's played in the series thus far and how effective he's been?
Yeah, so I didn't mind it yesterday, him not playing as much, because one, like they didn't have to worry. Like it was kind of smart for them to go small because their small was still bigger than Phoenix's small with Ayton out of the game for so much of the second half there, and Booker, you know, whatever's up. I am curious to kind of see if there's an explanation about, you know, Booker just, you know, playing so little. And obviously he was not very good yesterday. But I thought it made sense because like Portis was really good in the offensive glass. Now, you know, Lopez has been very good in the offensive glass at times throughout these playoffs as well. But I didn't mind that as much because they could go small, but you still have, you know, you can go, you're bigger than the other team. And obviously Booker is probably the guy who's going to give teams the most difficulty on switches. Obviously CP can do his thing, but I think Booker is more likely to turn the corner and, you know, either finish the rim or make a pass or something like that. So I didn't mind it yesterday, but I would be hesitant to say, oh yeah, we should be kind of platooning our 4/5 with Portis and Lopez kind of 50-50 there. Because Ayton's not going to get in foul trouble again, most likely. I mean, he's only averaging 4 fouls per 100 possessions in these playoffs. He's barely gotten the foul trouble through, I think they've played 20 games now or so. My math is probably off there, you know, but they played, you know, a lot of games in these playoffs and he's barely been in foul trouble. So I think you need him out there because Ayton's going to play a ton. And the fact of the matter is, for the first two games, Lopez was their second best player on the aggregate. Obviously, you know, maybe Chris Middleton was a little better in game one, especially with that torrid third quarter he had. But Lopez was good in both games. So I think maybe that 28 to 32 minute range is probably good. A lot of it depends on Portis too and how he's holding up defensively. But like they can't do what they did in games one and two, where you're like, and PJ Tucker was much better yesterday. Did a really good job of kind of exploiting, you know, Chris Paul, Devin Booker on the offensive glass. And obviously he had a three, he had a couple of other nice plays there. But I just think the game flow made it so Portis could play a lot yesterday and Lopez didn't have to, but it doesn't feel sustainable because I don't think Ayton's going to get in foul trouble. I don't think Devin Booker is going to sit out, you know, that long of a stretch like he did yesterday. So I want him to play more because I think he's been quite good. I know he wasn't great yesterday. I mean, he was solid, but I don't think they should look at that game and go, we can win comfortably with Brook Lopez only playing 21 minutes because of circumstances. Even if there are some replicable things, a lot of replicable things about what the Bucks did, Booker and Ayton playing so little in the second half doesn't feel like something the Bucks should bank on moving forward.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense yesterday because there was no reason to have to, you know, live with those like defensive matchups you have to go to when Lopez is on the floor. You didn't have to do that when Ayton was in foul trouble like he was, and there was no Devin Booker, like you mentioned, to really exploit those mismatches. It just made sense to play a lot more Portis and a lot more Giannis rather than Brook at the five. it's just, it's interesting. You bring up that he's been like their second best player in these, in the first two games in the series. He's been largely like the second best player at times during these playoffs altogether. It's just, he's been a very, very consistent contributor. And it's sort of a little disheartening to see him not play as much. And I'm sure we'll get into that when we talk about Bud. But there are instances where he's just, it's, it doesn't make sense to play him. Again, he's not like a perfect player, but he's shown that he's not, he's capable of not getting played off the floor in instances. He can still hold his own in terms of mismatches. It's fine. It's a little bit overblown, but you know, he has his limitations just like any other player. And sometimes it works out to not play him as much. And that's why I was okay with him not playing as much in game three. But I do agree with you, Jackson. I think he should be playing like a significant role going forward because Ayton's going to be out there a lot more. He's probably not going to get in foul trouble again, like you mentioned. It's, that's the key for Milwaukee, realistically, if they want to really take a stranglehold of the series, is to try and get Ayton in foul trouble again, because the non-Ayton minutes are just untenable for Phoenix against this Milwaukee team and their size, especially with the homie going down. It's just untenable for Phoenix. They have to rely on DeAndre Ayton to play big time minutes. And I think he will. He's definitely capable. He's shown everyone in the entire world that he is more than capable of being a star level player in these finals and in this postseason as a whole. He should be back on track to play, you know, 35, 40 minutes in game four and going forward. It's just how long can Milwaukee just sort of like attack? Because they're going to go out there in game four right from the jump and attack Ayton. They want to get him in foul trouble quickly, or at least they're going to try to. They probably won't succeed, given that, I don't know, maybe the whistle won't be the same in game four as it was in game three, but who knows. But it's going to be their game plan to try to get Ayton in foul trouble, and maybe that means less Brook Lopez, but it largely depends on DeAndre Ayton in terms of Brook Lopez minutes.
Yeah, I tend to agree, and like I said, I had no problem with him not playing much yesterday. That wasn't like, I think we're all kind of in lockstep on that, and that part of it. But the first two games, I thought it was pretty inexplicable, indefensible, I guess would be the best way to put it. Like, I get you wanting to go more perimeter base with Pat Connaughton closing, but PJ Tucker wasn't very good the first couple games, and so if you want to go with that, like, at least go with, you know, the guy who had been good, and Brook Lopez there. So really curious to see how Bud approaches that moving forward, because I think you're gonna have to play the guy who I think at this point has been your third best. I tweeted during the Hawks I thought Lopez had been the second best, but Middleton's put together some pretty nice games since I tweeted that. So I would say third best at this point. But as you said, Rohan, there's been stretches where he's definitely been their second best player. And so I think as a coaching staff, you know, yes, there are times where it doesn't make sense to play in heavy minutes, but for the most part, you should be playing. Like, I just think you're putting yourself at risk if you're not going to play one of your best players. And it's not like a situation where it's one of your best players through regular season who's just struggling. It's a guy who's been one of your best players for the last 3 years now and is having a really good run. So I would say I'm a little worried about how Bud manages that given the first couple of games. But I understood game three, but it is something that I'm very much looking to monitor with Ayton and Booker, kind of the two guys who are, you know, key to Brook's presence one way or another. Likely being a much bigger part of the second half, you know, moving forward.
The Bucks starters, still their best lineup in the finals so far. They added a lot of minutes and a very good net rating. Some of that, granted, came, I believe, in the third quarter when they beat up on the Suns when they weren't playing guys. But still, I do think again, talking about things that might seem like oversimplifications, play the best five guys more, and it tends to have good results, even if the matchup isn't ideal. We've been dancing around it a little bit. Let's talk about the real story with Bud. And I think all of us now have been driven crazy by the tweets that are, I joked about it earlier, no adjustments, same old Budenholzer, no adjustments. And it's like, not even close. I think this whole playoffs, I think a lot of it, I don't want to say a lot of it, I think some of it is probably player driven. We've already heard that Jrue Holiday has had input and has made his thoughts felt on certain approach. PJ Tucker has, you know, in media availabilities, pleaded for certain coverages or tweaks, namely not helping him as much when he was guarding Kevin Durant. So I think that's part of it, but that doesn't matter. At the end of the day, credit to Bud, who has been very proactive. I mean, something like Giannis coming out of the gates guarding Kyrie Irving in the Nets series. That's not happening a year or two ago. They weren't that wide. I mean, look at the Eastern Conference Finals when never guards Kawhi, doesn't guard Jimmy in the bubble, and eventually gets hurt. And, you know, Wes Matthews actually did a really good job and doesn't play in two fourth quarters very inexplicably. But that there's the real Bud problem. It's minutes and rotations and who doesn't play and who does play. I think that's been more of a consistent problem all along. But if you talk about flexibility, adjustments, trying things, we've seen a ton. We've seen all sorts of things. I mean, you mentioned it earlier, the whole gamut, basically. They haven't done zone. I hope they never do zone in the series.
They suck at zone. They're terrible at zone.
They cannot do zone. They didn't try it as much. The switching started bad, but they got better. The zone, it's not the time to try and bust out the zone. But I want your just general Budenholzer thoughts, Jackson. I think he's one of the harder coaches to talk about because not even polarizing. I think just most people have written him off that he sucks and he's terrible and irredeemable and everything else. And we've certainly all, two of us at least on this podcast, had our issues and levied a lot of mistakes and things at Bud. But, you know, he's actively coaching. He's doing stuff. It's still worth analyzing and seeing what he does wrong and what he does right. And there's been some of both, like, honestly, there is with pretty much any coach.
Yeah, I think overwhelmingly, honestly, Bud has been pretty good. Like the adjustments to me matter more than the rotations. Every person weighs coaching differently. Like my goodness, I'm stumbling over my words here. The rotations have been kind of maddening. No disrespect to Jeff Teague, but like he just doesn't deserve minutes in this series. Like he just hasn't. He's not hitting threes. He's still slow as a decision maker. He's getting beat on the perimeter defensively. You just can't play him. It's not only that he's playing, it's the fact that he is he's organizing sets and whatnot. And it's like, if you just want to dice him as a spot up shooter, sure, I get it. But like, he shouldn't be running pick and rolls and taking floaters and whatnot. But I really like what Bud's done with the adjustments because I think it has to an extent he's working uphill a little bit. When Drew's done some really great things defensively in this series or in the playoffs, but the fact of the matter is he still has a sub 50% true shooting and decision making offensively has been pretty rough. And that's a guy they're entrusting a lot of possessions through. Chris Middleton has been, as you said, Ty, gotten better as the playoffs have gone on, but still kind of some inconsistencies in his game. And so when you get that, from your second or third best players, it can be really tough. So any small adjustment you make, sure, it could be better if you played Jeff Teague 0 minutes rather than 8 minutes, but it's more important for those guys to play better. So I've been mainly impressed with Budenholzer, even if I think that the rotation should be shortened and going nine deep in the NBA Finals or the Eastern Conference Finals, is not something I would do and deserves significant criticism. But the adjustments do matter, and I think those have been really impressive. But at the end of the day, the players are the ones who deserve the most credit and responsibility for success or failure. And I think, to an extent, Bud can only do so much. And so you don't want to give him too much credit for some of the adjustments, but you don't want to give him too much blame for some of those rotations because you don't want to harp on him playing a guy 8 minutes in a game when Drew Holiday is 4 or 14 from the field or Chris Middleton is giving up open three after open three like game two. So obviously Chris has been quite good, as of late, especially, so I don't want to, attack him. But that's kind of my long-winded way of saying I've liked what Bud's done. I think more focus should be on the players because that's what's most important at the end of the day in a sport like this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that sentiment. It's just, it's impossible. I saw a lot of discourse in terms of Bucks Twitter after the game two loss. One of the two. It was, why did Bud play Jeff Teague or Bryn Forbes for X amount of minutes when if they didn't play that, they would have lost. They could have won the game. It's like, no, Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday couldn't hit the broadside of a barn for the entirety of the game. Like, that's why they lost the game. That's not on the rotations. I think one of the main criticisms of the rotation and one thing we've talked about here on this podcast is just just the allotment of it, not necessarily the allotment of how they sort of fit together in terms of actual lineups on the floor. We've seen a lot of three-man bench lineups out there, and it's come as close as Bud has come in the last couple of years to doing those full five-man bench lineups in the playoffs that we've seen in the past. But we've seen too much of like Forbes, Portis, and Connaughton all out there at the same time early in games, and I think that's the gripe more than sort of minute allotments, because I think Jeff Teague is fine. I agree with you, Jackson. He's running way too much out there. He can't hit a floater or anything to save his life. But it's better than whatever Bryn Forbes is attempting to do on the basketball court right now. He can't hit rim on the majority of his attempts anymore, which is just a glaring problem. And so you can't really play him anymore. So you kind of have to play Teague, especially with this. We've said this before, but just Dante being out, that's so crucial in that the guard depth is severely limited. So you have to either size up Connaughton or you just have to, play Jeff Teague for a couple minutes a game. But yeah, I think it's more of like playing multiple bench guys at once and not having at least three or four starters in there at one time more than the actual minute allotments themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really fair, and I guess that would probably be my. I guess when I think about it now, when I'm watching the games and whatnot, that is a bigger criticism in the moment. So I must just. There's so many different things going on with this series and swirling my brain well around the Bucks and Coach Bud and whatnot that I just get them. I definitely agree that would be my bigger gripe with the rotations than the actual minutes. But yeah, I am bummed that we were robbed of a Budenholzer Doc Rivers Eastern Conference Finals. We would have gotten about 10 bench players out there at the same time, and I guess we might have gotten it anyways with Nate McMillan doing a similar thing. But it would have been quite the show there. But fortunately for the Bucks and their fans, Bud makes adjustments in a way that Doc had not shown an ability to do. But anyhow, I digress.
It would have been fun to see which one could outdo the other. Just a duel.
My money would certainly be on Bud there, no doubt, given his, like I said, his adjustments in a way that Doc doesn't really consider significant adjustments.
Well, I was going to, I mean, you know, bemoan the lack of this. Monty Williams is going very deep, and I know Ayton's foul trouble had a lot to do with it. I've already, on the post-game three pod, made my stance known that not playing a guy extensive minutes because of four personal fouls is like a self-defeating prophecy. Like, it's a lose-lose situation. You shouldn't do it. You get the worst of if the player does foul out anyway. There's no point in holding him to
you. Don't light the spark plug for me on this one, Ty. Oh, my goodness.
Are you in agreement or are you opposed to
it? Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Ayton played 4.5 minutes. Like, he didn't foul out. Like, I just... And it's not just that; it's the fact that like the Kaminsky minutes were awful. Like it's, and it's not really Kaminsky's fault. Like, you should know he's your third string center, and just like it just drove me wild, and it drives me wild whenever a coach does it, because you are taking a guy out so he doesn't foul out, so he can't play. So you're basically doing what you think is going to happen, and it's just, and especially with a guy like Ayton, who deserves the benefit of the doubt at this point. Like, he's not Jaren Jackson, right? He's not a guy who, like, oh yeah, he's gonna foul out, and so
the Nassus.
I did not like the game Monty coached yesterday. I think Monty's an excellent coach. He's done a lot of tremendous things this year. He has undoubtedly kind of cemented himself as one of the better or best coaches in the NBA. But like, he had way too many minutes out there when CP and Ayton weren't on the floor, and given the way Booker was struggling, it didn't make sense. He went too deep. Like, Kaminsky shouldn't have played. You're not getting a functional big man in that sense from Kaminsky, right? Like, you're getting, if you want to use Kaminsky, like, use him as a floor spacer, like try and run some more double drags, or maybe Mikel is the roller and Kaminsky's drifting out to three. Like, don't use him as a normal, don't use him in eight and drill, because he can't do that. So, I was definitely unenthused by Monty's kind of coaching game yesterday. And a lot of that had to do with kind of how he handled Ayton's minutes and the fact that the dude played 4.5 minutes the second half, and he didn't play at all. He played not at all after the 10-minute mark of the third, and then he picked up a fifth in the fourth, and they took him out. And it's like, you're down 20. What are you taking him out for? Like, you're not going to come back in. And sure enough, like, I voiced my displeasure with that decision when it happened in the moment, and said that he probably wouldn't come back in. And sure enough, the game never got close, and Ayton sat on the bench and played 24 minutes in total. So, yeah, I think, you know, you criticizing Monty for his game yesterday and kind of how he handled the rotation is certainly warranted, especially as we kind of, you know, juxtapose it with our grievances with Bud.
Well, to me, it's really just like, and I saw you had something, Rohan, but it's just, Bud is not going to be the, like, it's, there's not going to be just one team who, does he trust that guy a little bit too much? If it's going to be both teams, I think it's just comforting for Bucks fans who I think go into most series assuming the coaching battle could get bad for them. Again, somewhat unfairly, as we've covered, some of the criticism is unfair, but certainly Bud's proclivity for multi-benchman lineups and, you know, Teague 14 minutes with bizarrely important role on offense and that kind of thing. Like, you look over Campaign 25 minutes. He's not played very well this finals. Craig at 15 after that awful collision with Giannis. Kaminsky at 14. Abdel Nader with 7. Meanwhile, Ayton with the fouls. Booker with whatever the hell happened, only at 29 minutes. But Mikal Bridges at 27, he's just better than those guys. Why is he not playing, you know, mid-30s minutes in favor of any of those bench guys who Phoenix's bench, outside of Cam Johnson, who has been just incredible all playoffs and in the finals, but everybody else just has not been very effective at all. It's putting it lightly. So it's just comforting for Bucks fans. Like, based on what we've seen so far, if that's even a push, it's you feel good about it. I mean, the Bucks have the best player in the series. If they're not going to get horribly outcoached, it really, like, comes down to how well can Drew and Chris play? And if they can play well, you kind of have to like Milwaukee's chances.
It's going to come down to a lot of, like you mentioned, Ty, it's who trusts their guys more, if you want to just firmly look at the coaching battle, per se. I have a fun stat courtesy of HP Basketball Matt Moore on Twitter. It's considering Monty Williams not trusting Ayton to play those type of minutes, like, if Ayton is on the court and Giannis is not on the court, the Suns have won those minutes by 20. Like, and just in Giannis and Ayton minutes, the Bucks are +3. Like, that's almost a pick 'em. They're so similar. It's such a small gap. And they're +21, the Bucks are, the Giannis non-Ayton minutes. It's a lot of the series is going to come down to how much is Ayton going to be on the floor. And because we know Giannis is just an alien at this point. He's going to somehow play 48 minutes 2 weeks after breaking his leg. It's going to be wild. And it's going to come down to how much is DeAndre Ayton going to play? Is he going to get in foul trouble like we talked about earlier? Probably not, but who knows? Especially with the way that the Bucks attack the rim and they only have one guy who's really going to match up in size down there at the rim for Phoenix, and that's Ayton. So how much Ayton is going to play is really going to dictate the rest of this series and how it goes. And like you mentioned, Ty, if that's what it comes down to, you have to like Milwaukee's chances a bit, even though they are down in the series still.
Yeah, I think, like, I'm pretty confident Giannis is going to be like who he's been, like, because as good as Ayton did in that matchup in April, like, I know Giannis had a great game and he was unable to play most of overtime because of a calf or a heel or an ankle, some small injury there. As well as he did, Giannis still got his. And Giannis was a different player back in February when those two teams played. So I'm not reading too much into that. But Ayton just, you know, I was talking with some people yesterday, and like, and Ayton's had a tremendous run. He's a very good defender at this point now. But he's not the instinctive defender that you need, I think, against Giannis. He's not the Gasol. He's not the Bam. Like, he's mobile. He's not Bam mobile, though. He's gotten more aware as a defender, but he's not Gasol. Like, it's just so tough to defend Giannis. And that's the thing is Giannis has definitely, like, I think, taken his game to a new level in these playoffs offensively compared to previous years. But he also has more favorable matchups. And that's not a criticism. It goes to show that, like, there are only very few opponents that can actually, you know, throw out the personnel to contain Giannis while also, you know, being good enough offensively still. And so that's part of where I think he's just at a disadvantage, Ayton, because he's not some hyperactive, like the smartest defender in the NBA. He doesn't quite have like the level of, I guess, brawn or like girth, maybe. Like Gasol is just a bigger guy than him, you know, in terms of kind of how I don't know exactly, but, you know, he can cover more ground. Like, you know, Giannis is able to get around Ayton in a way that only he really could get around Gasol, or, you know, when Gasol would help a lot too. So that's the biggest thing. Is like, I think Ayton's gonna, you know, be a good player in this series as he's been for most of it, but I think that Giannis is just too much of him, despite some flashes where Ayton gives him issues.
I think I'm just, you know, I've talked about before, just generally the Bucks, maybe their one kind of intangibles advantage. And if you want to tell me, throw all this away at Jackson after I'm done, that's fine, because I know, you know, I have data for something else. There's not data for this, but just the fact that they've faced elimination in these playoffs, right? Like they were down 3-2 to Brooklyn and came back and win. And obviously a huge gut check moment against Atlanta, not only losing game one at home, but also you lose the game where Giannis goes out. How is the team going to respond? Clearly not facing elimination, but certainly seemed like that series could have gone very, very badly, very, very quickly. And then they run off two straight without him. But more so looking at just, you know, how Monty and the Suns have approached important games in the playoffs. They haven't faced elimination, so we don't know like what a game seven rotation would look like. But game four against the Lakers, and this is the first round. This is a very long time ago, I understand, but it's the one game this whole playoffs where Phoenix has gone in down. They were down 2-1. I think it's the last time they trailed in a series, I'm pretty sure. Four players played first half minutes, including more than 3 minutes for Frank Kaminsky. So I do think it's going to be a similar thing, and I do, just to kind of compound that point of like, that's not going to be a Budenholzer only thing, and Bud might shorten up more or faster than Monty in this. I mean, we saw Brooklyn by the end, it was six guys, and Portis was gone, and Forbes was gone, and I think Forbes played 4 minutes in game three. I think we're there already. I mean, maybe he gets another minute or two to see, but that this has been kind of the Budenholzer approach to every series. And I know, I forget if it was Kevin Pelton or someone else a while back in the playoffs had the stat of like, most of the time, this is how rotations go. It's per series, not round by round when they shrink. Each series, you know, from one to seven is when they shrink. So, you know, I think Portis is going to get a longer leash than the Nets series. I think he's still going to, there's going to be some trepidation from Bud to play him long minutes in every game. He certainly showed something in game three. Forbes might be done. I think we're going to see less Teague as we go. It'll just be interesting to see how both teams handle that. And again, just another example of there's, I think, some value in, you know, the Bucks have been through this before this postseason. Phoenix, outside of that Lakers series, they kind of have just cruised. And I think that's a positive and a negative in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's worthwhile. I think I think that's a great point from I think whoever it was that mentioned kind of the rotation strength throughout a series rather than round to round. I think, you know, just, you know, watching these playoffs, I think that's absolutely true. I'm sure whoever, you know, tweeted that out or wrote an article had it statistically based. So of course my affirmation means nothing there, but yeah, I think that's worthwhile. And I think that, you know, as we project this series and look ahead to kind of see who's going to have the upper hand, like I'm really fascinated to see, like, what Devin Booker do we get? Like, I talked about it yesterday, and this isn't some indictment on him overall as a player, but, like, he's been pretty dang inconsistent in these playoffs. Like, and some of that's outside of his control. Like, against the Lakers, Chris Paul had one arm, and so the Lakers just didn't guard him off the ball, and that made things really tough for Booker. In round two, he was dealing with a broken nose, and trying to adjust to a mask on the fly. And at the same time, even before he broke his nose in game two, Pat Beverly was giving him some issues, but, you know, he was really good in game two in this series. Wasn't bad in game one, but didn't set the world on fire. And then yesterday he was pretty dang bad. You know, three-point rate of 50% is not his game. Settled for a lot of shots. I think he really kind of just took the first opening available to him. And you know, he sat out a lot of that game yesterday. He came out early of game two, and he just said it was like maintenance, get a couple minutes rest. But I am curious, like, what Devin Booker do we get? Do we get the one who's had some incredible games where he beats good defense with his incredible shot making? Or do we get the guy who maybe rushes decisions a little bit and is a little bit sloppy as a passer and has some struggles defensively? Like who are we getting there? So that's the one thing that we haven't quite discussed about the series moving forward that I'm really fascinated by, because, like, I'm not going to speculate anything specifically, but something just seems a little off. Like, whether he had some a wrap on his wrist yesterday. Like, maybe he's nursing an injury with his wrist. Like, maybe the nose is bothering him a little bit, and so he's a little less, he's a little more trepidatious about attacking the rim and getting to his spots in the paint or the elbows. Like, he just doesn't quite seem himself, and there's just with the minute stuff too. So I'm not going to speculate anything in terms of, you know, what's actually going on, but I just want to know, who do we get? Which Devin Booker do we get? And we might not get the answer, because, as I said, he's been pretty up and down these playoffs despite having some really, really awesome moments.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I had a stat on the pod yesterday. This was game three was the 10th time this postseason Book has shot below 42% from the field. The Suns are 5-5 in those games and 9-0 when he's above that. So, and he still scored a lot in some of those below 42%. I mean, it's volume players are just going to have low shooting nights where they still score. But just generally, I mean, when he's been efficient, they haven't lost. So it's a huge question for the Bucks, and I think that ties back into adjusting the defense. So whether it's switches on players that he feels comfortable with or running the drop, which it just doesn't seem like we're really going to see anymore, it's straight up drop, you can't let him get comfortable. I think that is something that the Bucks took away from game one, is like he and CP as well, but I think really Booker, they said, listen, you're going to hit some shots, but we're not going to let you get in a rhythm. We're not going to let you look at open look after open look. You're going to have to beat a guy and score, and you're going to do it. It's going to happen some possessions. Those guys are so good, but we're not going to let you get in this rhythm and shoot 50% from the field because, you know, no one's beaten the Suns this postseason when he's done that. So it's going to be fascinating. I do think that's the big question. You know, I'm glad he's not getting unnecessarily pillared. I think it's worth having this conversation, these questions that we're asking right now, and that was my stance yesterday as well. If this was Giannis in the same situation as Booker last night, I can't even imagine what the reaction and blowback would be. It would be excessive. Again, I'm glad not everyone is going out of their way to crap on Devin Booker. I don't know what was up either, if it was an injury or what. I've heard some people say more rest. They had more days off than the Bucks, and Giannis just got his leg screwed back on, and that was an extra rest day. I don't know how much rest would be necessary, but whatever it is, you know, hey, it's a good sign for the Bucks, and hopefully it's something that, you know, it's from a Bucks perspective, hopefully it's not an injury, but just if it's truly just, hey, you weren't playing well, we're just going to sit you and not do it. I don't know what kind of reaction that has. Like, I don't know. It's a very weird situation. And I was surprised he didn't, like, that Monty didn't just stick him back out there for a few minutes just to avoid this literal conversation.
Yeah. And I think, you go, Ron. I'll follow up after you.
It's, you mentioned Jackson, you mentioned his 3-point rate. I feel like, Milwaukee's doing a decent job. Again, they're not doing perfect, but they're trying to make Chris Paul and Devin Booker turn into pull-up three-point shooters, which Chris Paul is not going to do. He's not going to take shots that he doesn't want to. Devin Booker will at times. Like, we saw him pull up for three in transition and tried to hit a shot over Giannis that just clanked off the backboard. And it's like, sure, you can hit that shot. You're very capable of hitting that shot. But when you're not in a rhythm and you're not, you know, shooting well, that's not going to be the shot that, you know, gets you into a rhythm. I was very critical of Chris Middleton when he did that in game two, tried to take that same exact shot, basically, and it just didn't go in. It's like, what are you doing, my guy, sort of thing. So it's a lot of it goes back to Milwaukee's defense, and that, like, one of the things Drew Holiday has liked to do now is just dart under screens quick, especially if they've started to set them higher, so that Chris Paul, it's like, if he wants to really dissect it, he's not going to beat Drew Holiday in terms of quickness. So if he wants to get around him, he's going to have to pull up for three, and that's just, he's not going to want to do that. Devin Booker, he's going to try to do that, and it's just like, he's going to have those nights where it just doesn't go in, like we saw in game one and now game three and game two even. He had, I believe he was 7 of 12 from 3, and all 7 of his 3s were considered contested by NBA's tracking data, which is on and off. It's not perfect by any means necessary. But it still speaks to, he's an elite shot maker. He's definitely capable of being that guy who can just hit contested look over again and again. But it's not going to be a real consistent thing, especially because we've seen, and you've mentioned this already, Jackson, he's been very inconsistent in these playoffs. Things have happened, obviously. There are circumstances. There's circumstances for everyone and for every team, especially these two teams that are remaining. Sometimes you just gotta live with it. And it'll be interesting to see how Devin Booker responds to this performance. Is he gonna learn from Milwaukee's coverages, or is he gonna be fall into the trap that Milwaukee wants him to fall into, is to take the shots that he's not his strongest at?
Yeah, and I think, you know, Ty, you mentioned, like, if this were Giannis in that position, I think that's obviously that it's an indictment on kind of how these things go, right? Rather than, like, saying that Giannis, you know, into that Devin Booker needs to desert, to receive the same criticism that Giannis might there. And that's kind of, you know, I was tweeting about it earlier today, but there's this drive to make every performance about something than just the performance itself. Like, we can sit here and criticize the way Devin Booker played and some of his inconsistencies without turning it into, oh, he doesn't have it. He's not a winning player. He's not a playoff performer. Like, none of us are saying that, and rightfully so. We're just noting that he's been inconsistent, and that's normal for a 24-year-old in his first playoff appearance. Like, he's having a very good playoff debut, all things considered, you know, dealing with Chris Paul's injury to start and dealing with his broken nose and adjusting to a mask. Like, and he's had some big performances in key games. So that's the thing for me, is that, like, it doesn't have to mean anything more than the fact he's just struggling at times right now. Like, it's not an indictment on him as a player at all. It just is noting kind of the criticism of his on-court play in the moment. But yeah, I think, you know, Booker is a guy who everyone builds out of college as being this great, great shooter. Like, Klay Thompson was the comp. Obviously, he's shifted the comparisons now, but he's not really a great three-point shooter. He's fantastic from mid-range. He's a very good free throw shooter. Like, has impeccable touch from about the free throw line and in. Just his ability to kind of change the level of arc on some shots and get the ball over and loft it in is incredible. So if you're turning him into a guy who is taking half of his shots from three, that's a win for the defense. And of course, if he hits 7 out of 12 threes, you're like, dang, that's a bummer. Like, that's really frustrating. But, like, process wise, you'll live with that. Now, you don't always have the option to live with things process wise in a 7-game series. But, like, you're seeing that when he takes 7 threes the next game and hits one of them, that he struggles more. So really, I'm curious to see how he responds. I think, you know, the Suns have done really well to, you know, kind of get guys going, especially Booker at times in this series, by just, you know, changing the floor alignment around him to give him more space. Because, I mean, every superstar and every great scorer prefers to have space to work with. But Booker is a guy, I think, even more so, like, really enjoys having space and kind of working in space. And so I think the Suns would better try and make more of a conscious effort to get him into space, because I don't think he really had that in game three. But we'll see. There's just something doesn't quite feel normal. Like, he didn't play at all in the fourth quarter here today. Like, and I mean, the game, yes, they were down 22 going into the fourth, but, like, that's not insurmountable. Like, I mean, it's tough, but, like, you're not resting the guy. Like, I don't buy rest. If that's something that people are saying, I don't think that could be a reason. Maybe that's what the coaching staff is saying, but that's not something that I can, like, that's something that I can, like, say, okay, that's fine. Like, I support that. So really, really am curious. There's a lot of things I want to see what happens in game four, but what type of Devin Booker we see and how they try and manufacture his touches and spots that he likes to shoot from is really, really interesting to me.
They had CP out there for a lot of those minutes, so I'm not buying straight up. If there's anyone you want to rest, it's probably missed a couple games last series, ancient Chris Paul. But one quick point more on Booker, and then I want to, whatever Rohan wants to ask for the last question. I know we're running up on an hour here. But, I mean, Jackson, you just made the point about Giannis on Twitter that, you know, it takes a long time for even the greatest players in the league to have their games completely translate to the playoffs. I think for a lot of reasons, it is a different game. It is harder, whether it's the whistle, but I think more so just the intensity and the focus on not even every game, but every possession for most teams. So, you know, you made the point for Giannis, and this is something I've been trying to keep in mind and voice over the last couple of years. I mean, people saying Giannis isn't that guy because he's 25 and can't beat a team full of great defensive players, basically only worried about him. So I think with Booker, that sort of applies too. I think it's easier a little bit for perimeter players, but still at his age, the first playoff run, you know, it's just, it would be silly to expect him to be just as good as he is in the regular season the whole time. I think it takes time for everyone. But Rohan, what's one more question or topic you're wondering about as it relates to these finals?
I think it's a fairly simple question. How do we think it's going to play out? We're at a tipping point of this series, realistically, because game four is essentially going to decide the series. 3-1 is obviously not insurmountable. We've seen it in the past, and that's very, very unlikely. There's a reason there's a lot made of that run, because it is very, very difficult to come back from a 3-1 deficit, especially in the finals without home court. So I'm saying essentially it's a tipping point, because if you lose, if you're Milwaukee, your season's essentially over. That's what it was going into game three, and it's going to be the same thing going into game four. So I guess just the series overall, and just game four specifically, Jackson, how do you think this is going to play out?
I still lean toward the Suns. Like game three did make me reconsider some things. Not that after game two, I was like, oh, it's a sweep. Like, no, it just doesn't, not how I picked the Suns in six heading into the series. I still feel pretty comfortable there. One, because like we talk about the Bud stuff, like I don't trust him to play Lopez the minutes he needs. Like, I just think those first three games, like, yeah, game three, I was fine with it. But the first two games, Lopez should have played much more and he didn't. So I'm worried there. I don't think Aiden's going to get into big foul trouble again. I know Giannis is going to continue to dominate. But then I, like, as good as Drew Holiday's been, you know, defensively, and I thought his decision making process, even outside of hitting five threes, was better. Like, I thought he made some really nice passing reads yesterday. Having get a nice play to Pat Connaughton, maybe a corner, also an assist on a corner three to PJ Tucker. But I just can't trust Drew offensively. Like, he's just been so inconsistent in these playoffs offensively, largely like not very good as a scorer. Like, I know his assist total has been pretty good, but I do feel like he still is leaving a lot on the table there. And so like, I just have more faith in, you know, not the game three was an outlier. Like, I mean, there are going to be a lot of outliers in a seven game series, but I just lean toward the Suns more because I think there were a lot of things that went Milwaukee's way. And that's not to say that, I mean, like, the Suns shot 50% on threes in game two. Of course, that's a huge thing, but I just feel more confident in, like, if things stabilize to how, like, these teams can normally play, I just have more confidence in kind of in Phoenix's big three to an extent, but also just kind of how the big three makes its impact. I feel more confident in Phoenix's side of things, but I think these will be some great games. Like, I do think Milwaukee figured some things out, especially on defense to really make things tough, because I didn't really mention either. Like, yes, Ayton didn't get a lot of touches down the stretch of that game after the 10-minute mark of the second quarter, but the Bucks also did better. Like, Middleton was really physical, denying him. They kept Giannis on him a lot. So that's just my way of, like, I guess, kind of hedging, but more so like, just I think these games are going to be pretty good, or should be on paper. But of course, one team is always going to shoot better from a three. That's how basically every playoff game goes. But I just lean the Suns because I have more confidence in kind of if everything is kind of at a base level. I think what they do is a little more replicable to winning these games than the Bucks.
If and I'm not saying this will happen, but let's assume the Bucks win game four. Not even necessarily a blowout, but a comfortable win in game four. And you're looking at a three-game series, two in Phoenix, of course. And not to say I don't care about the number, but do you still lean Suns in that scenario? Or at that point, do you go, maybe now I think about the Bucks a little bit more?
Yeah, that's tough because I think it's important that, like, yes, not every team has the best player and it wins, you know, a series, of course, but you should feel confident if you have best of three with Giannis on your side. But it's too tough for me to say one way or the other, just because I don't know how that victory would come. Right. Like, I don't know. Right. Did Giannis dominate again? Did Monty, you know, bungle the rotations? Were they still struggling to create offense? Like, what happened there? So it's just too tough with that broad hypothetical, but it certainly would make me reconsider because I would be under the assumption that Giannis plays very well again, because nothing has shown me otherwise through these games. And that would, you know, like I said, if you got the best player on the floor in the best out of three, I know you'd have two games on the road. It would still make me kind of like, I was still in the sun just kind of with that hypothetical, but it would certainly change depending on kind of how they got to that result.
Very difficult road for sure.
Yeah, you're a smart Jackson. You're a process over results guy. I should have known that wasn't the right way to frame the question. But I'm too high on the Bucks again. I think Bucks in six is in play. If
it's a
not
trap,
probable.
Absolute trap.
I know it is. I know it is. Honestly, you want to know my hotter take than Bucks in six is still alive?
Of course.
I guess no one does. Okay. I think they could win even if they went down 3-1. And I
you're drinking the Kool-Aid.
I don't think they would, but I think they could. And it comes back to Giannis, though, which is the point Jackson made. It's like if you get three straight good Chris games, very good Chris games, down 3-1, you just know, I think, what Giannis's output is going to be now. I don't know if there's a good answer. I think he's just elevated past that. And it's just the margin is looser for the Bucks now. I mean, they can still lose, clearly. We've seen them lose twice in this series, and once even when Giannis was great. But you just need enough from the other guys. And it can be some combination. It doesn't have to be everyone else on the roster, but, you know, Chris averages 28 from here or 25 from here, which certainly possible for him to do based on what we've seen in other series. It just feels like they're going to have opportunities to be in the driver's seat. And I'm not writing off Phoenix. I know they're a very, very good team, a great team, deserving to be here. The Giannis thing is a cheat code, and I think the Bucks have figured out other stuff too, but that's where the confidence starts and ends with me. That's how I woke up this morning feeling. I didn't rewatch the game, but just thinking back, like, when you got the guy who's putting up the Shaq numbers, it's hard not to feel good.
Yeah, I think too, what I was impressed by and encouraged by from a Bucks perspective, I thought their execution level was I think that was one of their best executed games of the playoffs. Like, I know Booker didn't play a ton, he missed shots, and Ayton was in foul trouble, or quote unquote foul trouble. But I just thought they executed better. Like, I think, because one of the things that, like, has frustrated me about the Bucks throughout these playoffs, and I know they're in the finals and they're three games away from a title, is I just am constantly frustrated by the level of execution at times for a team that's this far into the playoffs. And I thought they were really good at that. And like, they had game plans and they stuck to it. Giannis dominated, Chris hit shots, Drew's decision making was better, Annie hit shots, the defense was great. And so that was most encouraging to me. But I am curious. I feel like the Bucks, the last couple, even kind of the start of the Bud era, it's a classic Charlie Brown meme, right? With the football and whatnot. And I'm wondering if eventually Charlie's going to kick that football, and the Bucks are going to kind of finally deliver on kind of everything they've shown it in spurts throughout these 3 years, and especially, you know, in longer spurts during this playoff run.
Ty, that's a bold take. You've had some takes, my guy, over the last couple of podcasts.
I'm high on Bucks basketball. I don't know what you want me to do about this. They're in the finals, Rohan.
Which is why I'm just happy to be here.
You know, better be optimistic about your team's chances, right? For winning the title in 50 years rather than... Hey, exactly. Ty's not claiming to be an objective NBA journalist here. He's a Bucks fan with a podcast, and he's optimistic about his team. So I totally respect it, but I get Rohan's skepticism too. You don't want to delude yourself into always raise expectations. So I get both sides of the ledger. I'm playing the middle. I'm playing both sides here.
It's wild because I'm never this guy. It's just recently.
That's why
the Nets series is what unlocked. It's the Nets series, and then when Giannis came back, obviously when Giannis seemingly got hurt, it was all, you know, fire and brimstone. But I don't know. Something's in the air.
The Nets series it broke me, and it made you optimistic, Ty. It's just a wild turn of events here. But I think we have, this was a fantastic conversation. Jackson, there's one more important question I need to ask you. I know you made an announcement about this, but there's plenty of places people can find you. Tell us about that and the house that Hinkie built.
So you can find all my Sixers-related podcasting on the Blue Hour Wire Network. I am wrapping up kind of my player grades for the year. I'll have a couple more episodes of that with the four most relevant players in the Sixers right now: Seth Curry, Tobias Harris, Ben Simmons, and Joel Embiid. So you can find all of that at the House That Hinkie Built podcast, part of the Blue Wire Network, wherever you get podcasts. And then general NBA content, you can find me at Dime Up Rocks. You can find me at The Analyst. Soon you can find me at Basketball News. I'm still doing some work with SB Nation's Liberty Ballers. I want to do Sixers coverage. A lot of my podcasts are live as well at Spotify Green Room. So I'm everywhere and anywhere in between. You can find me basically anywhere. And the easiest way to do that is a centralized location. You can follow me or just find me on Twitter at @JackFrank_JJF. Everywhere I'm putting out NBA content is listed in my bio there, as well as an email if you would like to give me suggestions for topics or anything in general or criticism. I'm open to all of it.
I just got to ask quickly. I'm assuming Embiid is number one. Is Seth Curry number two in player grades? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to spoil it.
No. So far, I think the highest grade, if I recall, has been, I want to say Tyrese Maxey or Danny Green, but I think Seth will get, I will spoil it. Seth is going to get an A+ for me. That'll be the first A+ of this series so far. Joel will probably get one, but I'll think more about it. We'll have to see how I weigh, you know, the injury and him starting a little bit in crunch time of games. But Seth will certainly get the A+ because of how good he was this year and how he basically just turned into a slightly lesser, slightly lower usage version of his brother in the playoffs there. So we've got quite a few A's, but Seth will sit atop the ledger there.
Maybe one day we will get the destined Bucks-Sixers series, because it's been written in the stars for years and years and years, and it just hasn't happened, just hasn't worked out.
I want to see how Giannis would face that defense. I think, you know, if he's faced two really optimal defenses against the Raptors and Heat the last couple of years. I think the one with Embiid, you know, Simmons, great help defender in Danny Green, a good help defender in Tobias Harris. I would love to see how, you know, this version of Giannis fared, but unfortunately,
plus Giannis and Embiid take those matchups really seriously.
Yeah, but yeah, we've had some great games. I mean, just over the years, just some really, really fun ones. And just level, I mean, the level that Giannis is playing at and the defensive level that Joel was at in these playoffs, it would have been really fun. So maybe next year we'll get it, maybe a second round series, you know, but at the very least I would like to see it quite significantly. But unfortunately, Doc Rivers and his rotations had other plans. this year wasn't the only culprit, but Shake Milton, all due respect to him, was getting fourth quarter minutes in game seven, and that's Shake had not earned those minutes. But I digress. I've talked enough about Doc Rivers and his faults rotationally over the last month or so.
It's okay. I think this audience will love it. But no, for sure. Make sure you follow Jackson on Twitter. Make sure you just get all of the content possible because he is one of the smartest people out there. It is an honor to have had you on this podcast. It's just your work is unparalleled. It's incredible. Make sure you check out everything he does. You won't be disappointed by anything. I promise you that. I can.
Oh man,
sure.
you might be overselling.
It's true.
Sure. I appreciate it nonetheless.
Ty, you'll back me up, right?
Of course. Team Jackson, we are on the Eurostep Podcast Network.
Yes, for sure. But yes, we will wrap up this episode of the Eurostep here on the Eurostep Podcast Network and the Blue Wire Podcast Network. If you did enjoy the show, make sure you leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Ty, do you have a rating for us?
I do have a rating. It's the last new one for now. So if you haven't yet, folks, you're listening, even if you're not on Apple, grab an Apple device, steal someone's Apple device, not literally for legal reasons, but acquire an Apple device. Eurostep Podcast Network, 5-star rating and review. Get it read on the show. Like Wahuba Chuck, pessimistically optimistic Taylor Desch, was always a fan of Jordan and Adam for the past few years at Wind and Six, and now that they have joined forces with Ty and Rohan, I'm more plugged in than ever. Nobody quite captures my mood swings like these four, as it seems each episode I identify with a different host's emotions over the most recent Bucks game. I highly recommend giving this podcast a follow/subscribe to help Bucks fans with their roller coaster of emotions. Remember, you can't hit a one-legged, off-balance, running push shot in the finals if you don't attempt a one-legged, off-balance, running push shot in the finals. Keep up the nice work, fellas. Shout out to Bryn Forbes, who inspired that motivational quote there. But a great review. Thank you, Taylor.
Yes, thank you. And make sure you keep those reviews coming. We'll read them out here on the show. But yeah, again, it just makes us feel better as well. Make sure you're subscribed on all podcast platforms of choice. Check out all of Jackson's stuff. Again, make sure you check out all the content across the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Go Bucks, everyone, and we will talk to you next time.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.